And I'm fucking livid that we are stuck in the timeline where Alex Jones is right.
Kind of works.
Oh no! Okay, no.
Why aren't the Amish afraid of COVID? Because they don't have TVs.
As I said, democracy is a system that reinforces authoritarian ideals.
I hope I don't get canceled. Talk to Steve.
Being a victim of a tragedy doesn't make you an expert in public policy.
But I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
Remember, they lost the Afghan war 10 years ago.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
I said, you don't get to tell us no, we're in the state health department, and I said, hell no.
It wasn't making Christianity better, it was making rock worse.
What the fuck do you have on your face, Olivia?
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies, and raise them to not be stupid.
Remember thinking, man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, shit posters, anarchists, and people of the internet, thanks for tuning in to another episode of O'Donnell for Liberty. As always, I'm your host, Justin O'Donnell. And before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you listen on, whether YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on the air at LRN.fm, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and sharing with your friends. And if you enjoy the content, you can join our production team by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell for Liberty. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell4Liberty. And make sure to check out our sponsor, snackswag.com, for all your favorite Liberty merch, including some brand new designs for t-shirts, hoodies, stickers, coffee mugs, and campaign merch. If you're a fan of the Jeremy Kaufman campaign for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire, you can get all of his Rogue-hosted campaign merch, sticking it to the man running a fantastically fun Rogue grassroots campaign for U.S. Senate here in New Hampshire. So go ahead and check that out on snackswag.com. And wear your principles and your morals literally on your sleeve today. And if you want to keep in touch between shows, follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans about the show at any time. And all these links can be found in the description of the video or podcast you're listening to, as well as on O'Donnell4Liberty.com. So check the description for that link and make sure to check it out today. Now, what's our topic for today? Declaring your independence. Something that should be at the root of every American's ideals and political values, valuing the virtue of independence. And I think back to like George Washington's farewell address after his time in his two terms as president. He gave a young nation a series of dire warnings on his way out. And what should have been the highlight of the nation's existence, George Washington warned of what would be the downfall of any young nation, and that would be entanglements and political affairs. And while foreign entanglements have kept us embroiled in war and tax beyond reason, it's been the partisanship of political parties that has kept us distracted and held at bay the entire time. And while Washington warned that political factions may seek to obstruct the execution of laws created by the government or to prevent the branches of government from exercising the powers provided them by the Constitution, the truth would turn out to be much more terrifying, as the entities of political power aimed not to impede government, but to control it to the disadvantage of their fellow man. No more is the Congress of the United States a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but rather a body elected under false pretenses with a directive to serve their corporate agendas at the expense of the people. And the parties have become a distraction. They no longer stand for anything except the opposition to each other in public debate, while working hand in hand to enrich themselves and mislead the people. But slowly, those who've seen the monster from the inside are beginning to wake up to the nightmare of blind partisanship and leave the behemoth before the damage becomes irreversible. And joining me tonight to talk about her exit from the political behemoth and the monstrosity of partisan politics is New Hampshire State Representative and former member of the New Hampshire Democratic Party, Ellen Reed. Thanks for joining the show tonight, Ellen. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
Well, as it's finally technically spring, there's no snow on the ground. It's a bit cold, but at least it's sunny, and I don't think I'm allowed to complain, or else we're going to get a random April blizzard.
I think we're supposed to actually get snow tomorrow, literally.
Somebody at work told me that today, and I'm refusing to acknowledge it. The calendar tells me it's spring, so it has to be spring.
It's spring. I'm with you. I'm with you, brother.
So What is your background? Like, you've been a Democrat as long as I've known you until recently, and we've been on the same sides of some political issues in the state house. We've been on the opposite sides of political issues in the state house. But one of the things that stands out to me, when somebody asked about whether or not you were going to be at an event, we had the Liberty Forum a couple weeks ago. They said, oh yeah, one of the independent reps wants to speak. I'm like, no, not him. And like, no, Alan. I'm like, oh, she's cool. Like, you've always been a Democrat who was reasonable and could have a conversation with me instead of just devolving into yelling and bickering and debating, even though we've had our loud moments for sure. But like,
I thoroughly enjoyed those moments.
What was your background that motivated you to, like, why get involved in politics in the first place? I usually ask people what their path to liberty and libertarianism was, but we're not there yet for you. So why did you get involved in politics in the first place?
Okay, well, let's see how brief I can be. I grew up in South Memphis in the ghetto. And, you know, talking about libertarians and freedom and liberty, we talk a lot about power, and specifically power as it relates to government, but money is power, and economic oppression is a thing. The inability to live life because of economic oppression. So that is my background. And to be fair, my parents were like hippies, like nudist colony hippies. So I had a very kind of socially libertarian background, but with like an economic justice kind of upbringing. And, you know, in college years, I guess you might, not the modern day version of the social justice warrior, but like go to the 90s and think about like good liberal activist. I was your good little college liberal activist. But at some point I felt pulled into too many directions. And I ended up concentrating on the one thing that was preventing us from seeing any movement on anything. And that was democratic reform. The fact that we didn't control our government anymore. We didn't have the government that we were all taught we had in third grade that was of the people, for the people, and by the people, like you said, that it just, they work for their corporate overlords, and the whole system is rigged. And I honestly don't care where anybody else stands on any other issue, taxes, war, whatever. It doesn't matter where we stand. If we can't engage in those good faith debates and have that process play out the way it's supposed to, in a way that represents people. And that's, we don't have that. So that became my number one issue. I worked for a few organizations on that issue and then ended up being recruited to run for office. And because we have a messed up system, I had not been declared ever. But because we have a messed up system, I declared as a Democrat so that I could get elected. And now I undeclared, so.
Presumably to get unelected. At least in the experience I've seen when people leave one of the major parties, they get unelected real quick. With the exception of Max Abramson in the New Hampshire House, who keeps getting reelected. He'll switch back to Republican for 2 days before the election just to get reelected.
He literally just texted me before the show started.
I think his case really just shows the ignorance of voters and the ignorance of like our political system as a whole, where we're having elected representatives dictate how we live our lives, but people aren't invested in learning about their elected representatives, because Max lives in a very heavily Republican district and he'll get pissed off at the Republicans halfway through a term and declare, I'm a libertarian, or I'm an independent, or I'm in the Constitution Party now, every single term. And then like 2 weeks before the next election, it's like, oh, I'm running as a Republican, and get reelected in a landslide. Like, his constituents either just don't pay attention, or
okay with it. I don't know. But I tend to agree with you that, I mean, that's the kind of the sad truth about even politics in New Hampshire, where the barrier to entry is so low and we represent all of 3,000 people. People still don't know us or even understand what our role is.
Right. And that's the crazy part, is like, there is an uneducation. There's a standard of uneducation or misinformation or being uninformed as a voter in New Hampshire, where your district is only 3,000 people. It's not only viable, it's possible and it's common for someone running for state rep to shake the hands of and have a one-on-one conversation with every single voter in their district and get the endorsement of half those voters and get a confirmation, yes, I'm going to vote for you, and then lose in a landslide because you had the wrong letter next to your name by the time they got to the polls.
Right, exactly.
So how do you trick that?
Well, so this is that's a huge question, right? Like, how do you get rid of the two-party system?
How did we get a two-party system? Why don't we start with that?
How did we get a two-party system? Your listeners are probably smart enough to know that that was never supposed to be the case, right?
No,
The framers did not want that. Madison, also in addition to Washington and others, wrote extensively about the toxicity of factions and warned about this being one of the main dangers because they didn't have a way at the time to figure out how to prevent it, how to prevent political factions that sought power from working in the system to concentrate that power for themselves. And the mathematically speaking, when you have winner take all districts, which almost all are, and when you have first past the post, which is our electoral system, you end up with the two-party system because basically your vote is either going to be, it's only going to count if it's for the front runner or the person who has the best shot of unseating or defeating the front runner. So that's why you end up in the two-party system.
And wildly enough, there is nothing in the Constitution that requires our elections to be first past the post or winner take all. And in fact, until like the 1940s, most states elected their congressional seats as multi-member districts. I think Hawaii and Alaska were the last two states to get rid of multi-member districts when Alaska went down to one rep after a brief period of time, and Hawaii got told, no, you have to change it. But for the longest time, like New Hampshire only had one congressional district and elected two and sometimes three reps at an at-large election.
But if you don't do something about first past the post, you end up with a single party sweep in that multi-member district anyway. So, and there are lots of options as you, and maybe some of your listeners know, I'm the ranked choice voting girl of New Hampshire. and there are other theoretical options, but of course that's the one that I support most strongly.
Everyone knows my opinions on ranked choice voting, and my opinions are not even commonly shared amongst libertarians, believe it or not. Most libertarians would support you with ranked choice voting. in fact, Karen Ann Harless, very popular in libertarian circles on the internet, is a huge stan for ranked choice voting and works with RCV Colorado. And me and her get into actual petty arguments all the time because she's just autistic and nerdy enough to engage with me when I bring up the math. And we'll go into a math rabbit hole for 2 hours. So.
Well, I'm happy to get into it because I actually really have been looking for a venue to pick apart approval, which is what I hear from all libertarians. But I think you wanted me on to talk about being independent and burning down the Democratic Party. And I kind of really want
that is one thing everyone slightly to the left of Bill Clinton agrees needs to be done. Slightly to the right of Bill Clinton is burned down the Democratic Party. Republicans, conservatives, a lot of independents, libertarians, even if you go further to the left of the Libertarian Party, the Bernie Bros, the Forward Party, they all want to burn down the Democratic Party. So why the hell is the Democratic Party still a thing?
Power. It goes back to what I was saying. It's the two-party. Well, it's what you said, never until last week was it more clear to me, and I'm happy to go into what happened last week, but never until last week was it more clear to me that Democrats as a party, not individuals, but as a party, do not want to win. They do not want to win issues at all. They want to lose quick and go home early. Because every time they lose, that's fundraising. That's fundraising. It's scary. Look how scary the Republicans are. If we won something like, I don't know, healthcare, then you couldn't fundraise on the Republicans are the reason you don't have healthcare.
Right. And the Republicans are willing to go home once they got what they want. So, like, that's the crazy part. Republicans are going to say, we want constitutional carry. They get it. They go home.
Well, I feel like the fear mongering on that side is often not based in like what's actually happening. Whereas, so it's just a different strategy. It's the same goal, but the strategy is let's make a boogeyman that's scary and fundraise on that. Whereas the Democrats are like, let's not win anything and fundraise on that.
I did joke that it would have been hilarious to me if like mid or late summer in 2020, like, Democrats get so far up in the polls and it's real close in the presidential election, and because everyone was campaigning on student loan forgiveness and UBI, like, that became the Democratic platform. Andrew Yang won. He might not have won the election, but he won the platform race. And the Democrats are like, that is all we have to campaign on, was Trump bad, student loan forgiveness, UBI. And I thought Trump was going to issue an executive order to do student loan forgiveness just out of the blue. And just eliminate the Democratic campaign for the rest of the
under
year.
Them, right?
Because that's a very Trump proposal, too.
Right, like, right.
Trump wasn't a conservative.
No. And he is a political animal. And that's the problem, is that every occupation attracts a certain personality type. And, you know, if you're on a power trip and like to make people subjugated, you might be attracted to, I don't know, law enforcement. But if you're a giant flaming narcissist that only cares about feeling important, it turns out you're attracted to politics. It's amazing. And like, seriously, like 85% of the people, it's not just national level, like even your local level, even your town, like I say a solid 85. I feel very confident on that number. 85% are like clinical diagnosable narcissists.
I mean, there's actually a really easy test. We just need to go ask them all if they think they are. And anybody who questions it won't be. And I don't think any of them will question it. It'll just be a hard no. But really, you'd think New Hampshire would be different. And you'd think New Hampshire would be different just given how different New Hampshire is in every way from every other political jurisdiction in the country. From us having the third largest parliamentary body in the world as our state legislature, to having like the pay of a state rep is $100 a year. So it's essentially a volunteer job that attracts...
That actually makes it worse.
Yeah. Well,
that makes it worse. No, seriously. I know it sounds beautiful. Oh, citizen legislature, volunteer legislature. The problem is, and I use the analogy, okay, what if I wanted to start a business in New Hampshire and I came in and I wanted to hire 400 of the best and brightest people in New Hampshire. And I said, I could pay you a competitive wage. I would have a pool of candidates to choose from that are probably decent. If I said I need 400 of the best and brightest and I can't pay you jack shit, then I would have kooks. And that's what we have. And it is not a representative slice when you don't pay someone for their time or even just like regular remuneration, just for their basic time. Only the independently wealthy, retired, you know, people who are, you know, in a certain situation who are doing this as a vanity project end up running, right? You don't get like regular working class, competent, you know, people with good ideas who are trying to do things.
So because I take it you're not in favor of the constitutional amendment to lower pay to 2 cents a year.
No. No. Because so, economic power is also a power.
It seems every session that comes by, there is an amendment and somebody proposes. Half the time, it's usually a joke to mess around with the pay rate of state reps moving forward. Like this time around, it was clearly a joke to reduce it to 2 cents to make a point. But I remember a couple of years ago, somebody said, we want it to be $100 a year, but $100 in $1,789. Adjusted for inflation. And then somebody did the math and they're like, we can't afford to pay 400 state reps 60 grand a year.
Yes, when it was put into the Constitution, that was enough to buy a farm, right? That was literally enough to buy improved land acreage, which is like my dream. So I would love that to go through. There was also the one to make it so that we were paid in silver coin. So that was an interesting one.
Well, I would have taken that one in a heartbeat.
Yeah. So. Marple was the one, but he had like dozens and dozens and dozens of bills in with no co-sponsors.
He also had a bill to say you didn't need a driver's license. So, great guy, absolute legend. But like, this is the kind of shit you get out of the New Hampshire legislature that I do think makes it kind of fun. Like the Salt Lakers commenting in chat says, "Live free or die, just no legal weed." Half the reason we have no legal weed in New Hampshire is because, like you said, the Democrats like to lose rather than win. And it's the past 6 years, it's been the Republicans trying to push for legal weed and the Democrats opposing it.
Right. And I would have thought, and this is not very libertarian, but the governor said he is going will sign if it's sold in state-run stores, right? And so that's what the Republicans have been pushing. Now the Democrats are opposed to it because they're opposed to the state making money. Like, what is happening? I mean, and okay, so let's just take some other examples. I put in a bill that would have been a property tax exemption for low-income people. It was enabling, so it had been town by town. They adopted on their town level. And the Democrats are the ones that fought me because they said things like, again, just like looking at the internal consistency of Democrats, things like, well, won't that put the burden on to people with two homes? And I'm like, what party are you in? So they don't want to win. I can name five issues right now that, depending on whether or not Democrats were in the majority or minority, they've completely flipped. Same exact language, same bill, same sponsor in some cases. And they'll just flip. Election Day holiday. That's low-hanging fruit that almost everybody, like people, not politicians, everyone, Republican, Independent, Democrat, everybody likes the idea. Democrats, when they're in the minority, they love it. When they're in the majority and they have something they can actually do, they kill it. So gerrymandering, raising the age of marriage, you name it, Democrats will flip whether or not they actually have a chance of winning.
I remember, so there's a bill that just passed, passed the House, hasn't passed the Senate yet. And I cannot believe it's passed the House. It's because it's wildly unconstitutional. I remember 4 years ago, it was proposed the identical language, except it was Democrats. It was four Democrats were the sponsors of it 4 years ago, identical language. And I went to testify against it. And I'm like sitting in the election law committee. I'm like, no, like, this is blatantly unconstitutional. Here are the five Supreme Court cases about this issue. You cannot do this. And the prime rep at the time, she stood up and she's like, I'm sorry, I didn't realize it did that. I'm going to withdraw it. We'll do it next year after we address that. She didn't get reelected, so it never came back up. This time around, it was a Republican bill with eight Republican co-sponsors and zero Democrats, but identical language and passed.
Yes. Yeah. And all the stuff I'm complaining about Democrats, like, I really want to be clear. It's not just Democrats. This is definitely a party politics problem. It is always about power. It's always about concentrating that power and playing these games to do that. So it's not like I think that the Democrats are unique. I'm just a little bit more bitter about it with the Democrats than with the Republicans.
So what was your final straw? What pushed you over the edge and say, screw it, F this, I'm going to launch the second independent caucus in 6 years in the New Hampshire House?
I was alone at the time, right? Like, there was no other independent for me to caucus with. So this was me going out on my own. But and Representative LaBranche joined me a couple months later. But what had been happening is there was a Democratic former chair, ranking member on my committee who had been blatantly unethical, like laughably unethical, not just in how she ran hearings, but she actually tried to change the law to personally benefit her own career twice. She tried to amend my bill, and then she also put in her own bill to change the qualifications for commissioner, which would have specifically put it at her actual qualifications, which she had openly said in committee at least a dozen times she wanted to do. She wanted to become a commissioner. So I have been calling her out like nonstop. And Justin, when I call someone out, I lack.
You're social. Allowed.
Yeah. No, I'm like, hey, you're unethical. Like, you know, like just like that. And it turns out after 3 years of that, she got sick of that and her friends were more powerful than mine. I got a call while I was in Maui on vacation in December that they were going to remove me from my committee. Now, Fish and Game is my committee. I clerk that committee under Republican leadership, which is something in and of itself. I've won 2 Legislator of the Year awards for my work on that committee. I've gotten bills through on that committee. I wasn't leaving my committee. So I told the leader of the Democrats, it wasn't Rennie, it was David Cody. I said, I guess I'm not caucusing with you then, because the way it works is they can only move me if I'm a Democrat. And he said, I wish you wouldn't do that. And I told him literally the actual words. I say, I'm not embellishing. I said, I wish the Democrats had an ounce of integrity or a backbone when they do call me. So there we go. So they're mad. They're mad at me.
It's funny because I had joked in the past several years ago. I had made a joke to somebody after me and you got in a bitter argument in the election law room, and people asked him like, "What was that about?" I'm like, "Oh, she's fine. She's actually a friend. If it weren't for this nonsense, she'd probably be a Green Party instead of a Democrat, anyways."
Yes. So I've been told the difference between a social Democrat and a social liberal. And the social liberals are classic liberals, John Locke liberals, who just think that we can work together to make people's lives a little bit better, which only works if government is under our control, right? It doesn't work if government doesn't actually represent us. And most people who think like me apparently are social liberals, except for social Democrats who they come at it a different way. They come at it from authoritarianism, and then they dangle out social programs as the carrot to get social liberals to get on board with them. So that's apparently the difference. I wasn't aware of that, the nuance before, but it's a thing.
Well, and they dangle out the social programs like under the illusion that they'll ever happen. Like, and that's the craziest part, is like Andrew Yang campaigned for universal basic income. The Democrats picked up that torch and we got a little taste of it during COVID with the stimulus checks, but like everyone knows that'll never happen. Like, in one of like the most honest things I've ever seen out of a Democrat politician ever was during the debate in 2016 when Jim Webb was on stage, somehow got on the debate stage. Jim Webb got on the debate stage with Bernie and Hillary Clinton. And after Bernie Sanders goes on about all of his pitch about like universal health care, universal basic income, universal this, universal that, Jim Webb just stops and is like, "Bernie, I love you. I have more respect for you than almost anyone else in the Senate. But who the hell do you think is going to pay for that?"
Now, I'm going to push back on you right there, because with the amount of money we put into our military, we could easily pay for a lot of this. A lot of this. And obviously, because government is messed up, there's a lot of waste. So, I mean, I'm going to pay for it, Justin. Me, I will pay for it in my taxes. Sure. If I'm paying taxes, I want fucking healthcare. I don't want to blow up little brown kids on the other side of the planet.
And I'm 100% there with you. But like, that's the excuse and the reason Democrats have used to dangle these. Like, oh, look, they work in Europe. But they work in Europe because nobody in Europe has a defense budget. They work in Europe because the defense budget for your average European country is the United States taxpayer who's footing the bill for all that. That's the reason they work in these small, very wealthy countries in Europe, is because they don't have the outstanding defense obligations that the United States has. And a lot of people don't realize like how much defense obligation the United States has from foreign entanglements. The other thing Washington warned us about, things like the United Nations and the Convention on the Law of the Sea and all these international treaties that obligate the U.S. taxpayer to be on the hook for the security of every other civilized nation on Earth to our own expense.
And if we all just prioritize the well-being of our population instead of war, then we would all be better off. But you're not wrong, but it's not a black or white either. It's not like we just have to tomorrow, you know, give up the idea of having any foreign presence and just focus on our people. I would be okay with it. But it's not black or white. We could say, how about not this trillion over here that we've done, and then move that over, right? Like, there's different shades of gray that we can fight over, and we can have those debates if we have a functioning government, which we don't. So that it all comes back to that. Yeah, there was something else, but
no, but and if we had a functioning government, if we, that's the real pie in the sky dream there. And like, if New Hampshire can't have a functioning government at our local level, how can the country, how can the United States have a functioning government if we struggle so desperately to do it in New Hampshire, where like, this is a pretty homogenous
state. All of that is by design. Okay. So they used to say all politics is local. That is so far outdated. It's laughable. All politics is national. They wanted it to be national. They, again, with the two-party system, and they're just campaigning against each other, and the other one is the devil. They wanted that to filter down. So now everything, it doesn't matter how local an issue you're talking about, there's always the little question, everybody's, are you one of them? Are you one of them? Are you one of those evil people? You know, that's the constant narrative. And then going back to what you said about Max Abramson's voters, the idea that they don't know, we don't know who to vote for, that's by design too. We are by design kept working half of all of our waking hours from the time our bodies are fully formed as adults to the time they're breaking down, and with just enough time to like commute, maybe make some food, shower, hopefully take care of your kid, and then get a little bit of sleep. Like, that's by design. Look what happened during COVID. COVID happened, everybody went home, and then all of a sudden people are in the streets trying to change something. You had massive like protests everywhere because all of a sudden people were, what? They had the energy and the time to pay attention and to try to change things. So, and I don't care which way you want to change it, but we need to make sure that people have that ability to do the things that make life worth living, like have control over government and have self-determination, or, you know, take up hobbies, travel, deepen relationships, whatever. Just live life instead of just working, literally living to work to make someone somewhere else rich.
So what can be done immediately? Like, taking ranked choice voting off the table, because I know that's going to be your go-to answer. What can be done immediately?
No, that's not my go-to answer. So ranked choice voting is one piece of the larger, like all my work before I got elected was in campaign finance reform. So there are a number of reforms, and the thing that we all need to do, that, you know, you're not a politician, you're just a person, is to make the reform your voting issue. And if you don't find out anything else about whoever you're voting for, find out where they stand on reforms like this. Making the system work, because again, we need the system to work and even to have those conversations, because none of the policies that come out of our current government represent what people actually think, right? That's it doesn't matter. There's actually a study, took 18 years. They studied 20,000 pieces of legislation that they had polling data for. It was Princeton and Northwestern, and they found after this huge study that while corporate interests and moneyed special interests were very predictive of whether or not bills passed or failed on the federal level, that the actual will of the average voter, and I'm going to almost quote this, had a statistical non-significant near zero impact on public policy. We do not have a democracy. Republic's a type of democracy for people who are gonna like, we have a republic, not a democracy.
But like, if you tell your voter to look for things like where somebody stands on campaign finance reform, where they stand on congressional ethics and things like that, you get somebody like all of the paperwork, all of the research, like that's published by the think tanks is going to point you to someone like Elizabeth Warren, who is an outspoken supporter of campaign finance reform, who's an outspoken supporter of banning out-of-state money in congressional and Senate races, who's an outspoken supporter of congressional ethics and all this stuff, and who, for the first time in my adult life, I found myself cheering on and agreeing when she was calling out the CEO of Moderna for taking a job as the director of Operation Warp Speed and then investing $100 billion of taxpayer money into Moderna without divesting his stock in Moderna. But at the same time, she, since having become a senator, is still getting paid a seven-figure salary a year to teach one class half-time, is still investing very heavily in Northrop Grumman and Boeing and BAE. Well,
we should just not allow them to invest. Like, they should not have any ability to buy stocks.
Well, it's not even necessarily stocks. Like, there's indirect investment, too. There's market-directed IRAs. Like, someone like Elizabeth Warren, who is, like, the closest thing you can find to someone who preaches the actual legitimate preaching of ethics and finance reform, turns around and invests her salary in military contractors and then gets on the Senate floor to talk about the need for a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
Because there are, yes, it's when you talk to people about this issue, it's popular, but it's not one of the kitchen table issues, the things that affect people's pocketbooks like taxes and healthcare and stuff like that. Did I just say pocketbook? That's weird. Okay. but what it is, this issue of the actual system that we're working within is the kitchen table itself. It's the structure that supports everything else, but it's not sexy. This is not people's number one voting issue. There's all kinds of number one voting issues, whether it's immigration or abortion or guns or taxes or whatever. This is never one of them. It never even ranks like in the top like five, probably usually not the top 10, because when you start talking about reform in the actual system, it's no longer like really tangible and visceral. It's more theoretical. People's eyes roll into the backs of their heads. But I will tell you that if for everybody old enough to remember both the inception of the Tea Party and Occupy, which happened kind of at the same time, I was in Occupy begging people to join up with the beginning of the Tea Party, because I'm like, can you imagine? Because that's not what it became, but in the beginning, it was like, the system is fucked. The system's fucking us. We're sick of this. We want accountability. We want government to be under our control. Occupy, that was the same point. But they started adding public breastfeeding and organic farming onto it. And it's like, can we focus? Liberals are awful at focusing.
I think a lot of people are awful at focusing, but like, I do know, like, out of the Occupy movement came some of the best libertarian activists I know and work with, who like started as just an anti-corporate government, like, it started going in there in favor of the big government answer to corporate government and neoliberalism and whatever the Occupy organizers told them to think, and then walked away realizing that government itself was a big part of the problem, and that maybe reform meant burning the whole thing to the ground and starting over rather than trying to fix it from within. That's where I'm at. I'm more of a burn it to the ground and start over type of a person. But you're still trying to fix it from within.
It's not an either or for me. It's like, I'm literally supporting anyone just trying to do something at this point, because it really is.
Yet you voted against secession.
I did vote against secession. Yes, I haven't. You haven't gotten me all the way there yet. Okay. But I will say that at this point, like I said, it's about making this everyone's number one voting issue. It has to be everyone's number one voting issue. It has to get past all of the sexy money-based issues that people like really, you know, are super passionate about. And some of those are by design, right? Some of those issues are wedge issues on purpose, specifically for the two parties to like foil off of each other and make money off of each other, right? We have to get past that. We have to hold government accountable, make the government work. And I know maybe some of your people don't like hearing like make government better, but like they want to hear burn it down. If burning it down and starting something new is the better, that I will do that, okay? Like, I just need it to not be this, right? And we have to get it to the point that it is the number one issue.
So if you want to make ethics and representation and reform the number one issue, how do you go about doing that in a world where the political dialogue and political discourse is so utterly dominated by corporate media and corporate press that's in the pocket of the major parties' power brokers?
I mean, that's a really good question. This goes back to, like, scale. You and I were talking about the idea of stockpiling weapons against the government and how scale comes into play there, right? Well, it's kind of like that, because to do this, you would be going into war against corporate America, and they've got the metaphorical nukes of money, right? So, but we are so divided right now, and I just socially speaking, and so hateful. I think people really want a little bit more unity and a little bit more collegiality, and it's so weird. So, like, although Democrats and I agree on 99% of the issues, my friends at the state, the people that I talk to and drink with, are all Republicans, because I think reaching out, and this is actually one of the, I teach America Government at Community College. There's several factors for a stable democracy that stabilized democracies over history. One of them is social cohesion. And it's the idea that I'm more invested in you as a human being in my community than I am in you as a political adversary, right? So just being able to acknowledge, you know, if you're more conservative, realize that your liberal neighbor / person, you know, whoever, is, they mean well, they're good people, they just want people to, like, have healthcare and shit, and, like, it's not about, you know, the devil. Just, you know, drink with them, realize that they're, you know, you don't have to agree with them, but just realize that they're coming from that, you know, a good, genuine place, and connect with them. And then you can connect on this issue, because this is the issue that we can all agree on, except for the people way up in party structure.
No, and I think I have a graphic for this. It really illustrates it. Let me see if I can find it. I'm great at this. Like, just, and this is just like the past, like, 15 years, just the drift in polarization between the two parties. Like, in 1994, the median position of Republicans and Democrats was almost identical, and it was the fringes and extremes of each party that were apart. But, like, the average voting block of representatives from each party has drifted farther and farther apart from 2014 to 2020, to the point where there's finally separation between the two parties. Like, but it's been that recent. That recently in our past, the parties worked together.
But let me, right, and let me make a delineation between the policy stances of those two groups, which may have been drifting apart recently, which is fine. That's fine. Having multiple opinions on things and talking about it is fine. And the hostility, just the animosity, that's where the problem is, because we're supposed to disagree. We're supposed to disagree in a way where I listen to you because I believe that you're a reasonable person, that you're, like, you're not trying to lie or fool me or whatever. And I listen to your facts. I listen to your background and your reasoning and rationale. And then you listen to mine, and we're supposed to, like, have this good faith engagement that, like, is based on logic. And we come up with, like, ideas to solve the problems that makes us both reasonably happy. Like, that's the process that's missing. The lack of good faith, the fact that, like, I'm not, even though if I'm a Democrat and I supported this bill last year, but now a Republican is sponsoring it, so I'm going to vote against it. That's the problem. That's what we have. And to that point, can I tell the story about what happened with the ranked choice voting bill?
Oh, do tell. So this is since the last time we spoke.
Oh, yes. Yes, the floor. So, strategically, I had two ranked choice voting bills in. One was the big bill that would have turned all elections eventually in staged implementation into ranked choice voting. The other one was a little wee little enabling bill. The reason I put the big bill in, even though I knew it wouldn't go anywhere, is for educational purposes. Mm-hmm. To do anything in the state house, you can't just bring a good idea. It has to be repeated and repeated and repeated, because people don't like listening to new ideas. And also because in the committee room, the big bill would be first. We do all, like, hours of testimony explaining ranked choice voting again. And then afterwards would be this little enabling bill, which seems really reasonable after 4 hours of, like, massive ranked choice voting. So I did that. the big bill, we did zero organizing on. Nothing. There wasn't even a minority report. There was no floor fight. There was nothing. We had a vote on that. No debate, no anything. And it was like 204 to 149 or something like that. Okay, fine. We expected that. Well, then I did all this organizing because I knew I had some Republicans that would like the bill. And in the hearing on my little enabling bill, Democrats were unanimous, which always means they provide a positive recommendation on their caucus guide. It was actually out of committee on a tie, which is almost unheard of. So the automatic motion was ought to pass. And I had all these like Republicans, and I tabled at the Liberty Forum. I spoke on the panel. I talked to so many people. I did chocolate elections and ice cream elections, and we did flyers and everything you can imagine. And I had 30. I had 30 at least, and then some maybes. And the Democrats were solid, right? They all supported it unanimously. On the floor, and we knew a motion to table was going to come. On the floor, the motion to table this was a day where our Democrats were losing tabling motions by like 178 to 158. Right? Like that's the party line. It was 178 to 158. This was 2-0, like it was a worse vote than the big bill. So I'm like, what happened? Because I had Republicans. So I knew it had to be the Democrats that voted against their own caucus recommendation and against congressional Democrat priority, because RCV stuff has been put into HR1 for years now. So I went down and I made a motion to pull it off the table and roll called it just so I would have the names. 53, mostly leadership Democrats. It wasn't the Republicans that killed it. I had the Republicans. The Democrats just decided that because I left the party, they would rather take a loss on a meaningful reform that they believe is good for the state and good for the people, but fuck the people, fuck 1.3 million people. After all, we apparently don't make laws for 1.3 million people. We make laws based on whether or not we're pissed at someone this day, a particular person in particular day. So that's what happened. And I'm in the process of doing something about that right now.
So very similar thing happened to Brandon Finney when he left the Republican Party to become a Libertarian after his frustrations a few terms ago. He had a phenomenal bill he had submitted prior to session, and it was like sweeping reform of the family court system here in New Hampshire that took a lot of power away from the state in infringing on people in family court systems. And it required the state to have a burden of proof before taking kids. It required a burden of proof before an alimony judgment could be passed. Like things that there isn't, like there's no burden of proof for the state to just take somebody's kids right now. They can just do it on a bench warrant, and then you have to go fight to get your kids back, and the burden's on you to go the other way. This was a sweeping reform that had support of NHLA, it had support of Alec, it had support of every think tank in the state, like on the conservative side, and House leadership. Like, yes, they had people, like not just Brandon, like other House leadership helped consult on the bill and write the bill, because it was that important. He switched parties, and House leadership showed up to the committee hearing, did not testify, just signed in against it, and had it killed in committee. Their own bill.
Right. So it's not, and you know, this is totally, I'm going to bitch about Democrats because those are the people that stabbed me in the back, but this is a party thing. This is a structural power thing. And when Tony LaBranche, you know, burned the Dems down in a unanimous consent, I was approached by Republicans, multiple, that said, sounded like he was describing the Republican Party.
And unfortunately, I think something similar happened to Tony's mushroom bill. It just got ruined in committee because he left the Democratic Party, even though it's something that like Democrats have been trying to pass in other states across the country. Like that was straight out of the National Democratic platform.
Right. Well, Democrats right now apparently have forgotten about legalization. So,
So it's wild, unexpected. Aureus has one big hell long of a comment in chat. I actually think it's a great comment because we're coming up on the end of the hour. And we do know that your go-to solution right now is ranked choice. That's been your baby for years.
one of my many solutions. One.
Yes. Aureus comments, here's my problem with ranked choice. We have a literacy rate that is astoundingly low. We have an education problem in this country. Most people don't have time to understand nor care until the day or week leading into an election. So how is ranked choice going to help? It seems that people will just make the vote on one issue. We need drastic change and reform. How will ranked choice ensure that the right candidate gets in? I mean, like, I get it. I just don't have faith that people are objective enough. And also, look what happened in Maine with ranked choice. Was any server in Maine happy last year wearing the cone of shame to serve healthy people? I don't know what happened in Maine. I don't know
what that, sir, do you, like, restaurant, sir? I don't know what that is referring to. Usually when conservatives complain about Maine, they complain about one race where the conservative didn't win. But the thing with ranked choice voting, so I'm going to get to the question about voters' understanding of it. The thing about ranked choice voting is that it can't solve everything, right? But what it does solve is the propensity that our system has of electing people who actually the majority didn't want. Right. So that's the spoiler effect. And this is why the spoiler effect is why we get shoved into the two parties, because you can't vote your conscience like you were taught in third grade. You were supposed to. You end up voting strategically. You might want to vote for a libertarian, but you can't because you're afraid of the Democrat winning. Or you might want to vote Green Party, but you can't because you're afraid of the Republican winning. And so you're forced into these two parties, which gives them all the power in terms of voter understanding. And this is something that's been done for decades across a dozen countries, 20 different states on the city level. In many states that have runoff elections, military ballots are done through ranked choice voting. Hundreds of organizations, even the GOP in Virginia, Utah, Illinois, all have done it for a couple decades, actually, in Utah. So this is not a new thing. The voter experience is extremely simple. It's not about education. I mean, yes, we need educated voters. You need that. But even right now, with the level of education that voters have, their will isn't getting heard in the election system. So this isn't like an either or. Can we have educated voters or ranked choice voting? We need both. But even if you have the best educated voters, our current system allows the spoiling and the strategy that would end up in many cases, and does, with winners that are not supported by a majority of the people. And so that's what it solves. The actual voter understanding, I was unclear about the comment whether or not that was related to voters understanding it. If you can rank your top three favorite ice creams, you can rank your three favorite or however many favorite candidates. It's not hard to understand. It's
so extreme. Here is where I disagree with that, is I don't think your average voter knows enough about three different candidates to try and rank them. And that is the problem.
They know enough to approve of them.
But regardless, so like I think the issue is party and partisan politics. I think we've reached a level of mass information where who knew, who could have fathomed that having the complete and total sum of human knowledge at your fingertips, unfettered access 24/7 would just make people stupider. I never thought that'd be the case, but it turns out that that's the case in the United States, that people got dumber with access to information 24/7. Thank you, Google. Thank you, smartphones. Thank you, Facebook and social media, for doing this to us. But I think the political system and the process we have as a whole today has reinforced people to be stupid, uneducated voters who do what the parties tell them to. And I think with ranked choice voting, if we do get it in New Hampshire, what's going to happen is people won't do their research, but they're going to get a postcard from New Hampshire Dems a week before the election saying, here's the order you're ranking. And that's the order they'll rank people in, because they were told to by the postcard. I think the same thing's going to happen to from New Hampshire Republicans. Like, here's the order you're ranking in. And people will do that. However, I think we can solve that problem at the same time by burning the whole thing down and building into a multi-party parliamentary proportional representation system for New Hampshire. Because I think if people were given the options between more than two parties that were all legitimate and had equal standing and equal chance to win based on a percentage of the vote to win seats, that people would align more closely with a party that shares their values rather than one or two major issues. And I think if you actually break down even just the number one issues of people, like you said, there's seven or eight. Why aren't there seven or eight parties? Because there's seven or eight different positions on each one of those issues.
Ranked choice voting allows those parties to flourish. It allows independents and third parties to compete on an even playing field because you're no longer penalized for voting for them. And so all this wonderful, like, multiple parties and multiple viewpoints and stuff that you're talking about is allowed by ranked choice voting for the first time.
Do it
in a
proportional representation parliamentary system.
And no, wait, it even gets better than that, because while that would be fine, when you have ranked choice voting specifically in multi-member districts, mm-hmm. ranked choice voting is done by single transferable vote, which provides proportionality. So instead of single member sweeps, you get proportional results. So it's not the same as proportional representation like a parliamentary system, but you end up with that same proportionality. You don't end up in a district that's like 60% one party. And so all of their seats are that one party and the 40% of that district is completely unrepresented. You end up with proportionality. So ranked choice voting is an easy and very close to passing, very like feasible way of getting a lot of what you're talking about done.
You have to get rid of single member districts. To get me on board with that one, you have to get rid of single member districts altogether.
I'm 100% on board, but the wonderful thing is New Hampshire is a wonderful place to do ranked choice voting because we do have multi-member districts, right? The state rep districts are very largely multi-member, and we have the first in the nation. We have first in the nation primary, and this would be making ranked choice voting so visible and provide really clear, meaningful results from the primary to the rest of the country. I'm not a personal, like, I'm going to be burned to the ground for this, but I would personally, if we were going to mess with the primary system, I would say we should have a national primary day. But that's a very unpopular thing to say in New Hampshire.
I don't think there should be primaries. I think so long as that there are political parties, and my first preference is that there is no political parties. I think that anybody who wants to be on the general election ballot should be have the same. Here are the rules. Here's how you get on the ballot, flatline, jungle primary, top two runoff. That's what it should be.
We can't do anything about the presidential primary, right? Because we're just New Hampshire. But if you institute ranked choice voting in a state, you can replace all of your primaries because you just have everyone, all the Democrats, all the Republicans, all the independents, all the third party people run in the general on the same ballot. And with ranked choice voting, you can do that and nobody's penalized.
Unfortunately, I don't think House leadership is ever going to give you the chance just because they're corrupt and they're so ingratiated in the system of protecting their own power, their own position, and their own rank within the structure and systems that they've created, which is unfortunate. But it's the state of the world that we live in, and it's the state of politics in the world that we live in. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for coming on tonight, Ellen. This is real fun. And anybody who doesn't follow, do you even have a Twitter, Ellen?
I do. It's at Ellen4NH, but I'm not really on social media. I have like a volunteer that will occasionally check it for me.
So you go follow at Ellen4NH and give her a reason to get on Twitter because it's the greatest platform in the world. And I'm not saying
I like
that
credit.
I'm not saying that only because I've been banned from Getter now, but which turns out, yes, the free speech platform is only free if you don't criticize Israel. So that's the quickest way to get banned from the right wing. If you want to get banned from right wing platforms, is to remind them that Israel and leukemia have one thing in common, the responsibility for the deaths of innocent children. So moving on to next week, we do have another show lined up for next week, and you guys have been fantastic. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. Thank you for hitting that big red subscribe button. If you haven't already, you know where it is. You can find it. If you're listening on Spotify or on the radio or on Apple iTunes, hit that subscribe button, leave a review, leave some comments, let us know what you think. And until next time, be free. Thanks again for tuning in and joining us tonight. make sure you hit that like button and leave a comment below to let us know your thoughts. If you haven't subscribed, go ahead and hit that big red subscribe button on YouTube and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live. If you enjoyed this content, you can join our production team on Patreon by following the link in the description. And don't forget to follow on social media and join our community Discord channel by following the links in the description as well. The best part of all of this is the community that we're building and growing. So go ahead and join us. And thanks once again to our awesome sponsors and patrons for making all of this possible. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast. So until next time, everybody, be free.